We have JC tonight.
Good evening. My name is JC and I'm an alcoholic. Sorry for that. I got a direction from the back that I'm JC number two from JC number one. Look, it's great to see a lot of familiar faces here tonight. Appreciate the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. It's been a little while since I've told my story. The first time I did was a number of years ago, and my sponsor at the time told me to not prepare a script, but to pray and meditate and just be a channel for my higher power. And so that's my purpose tonight. So we'll see what comes out. My continuous sobriety date is April 22nd, 2018. And I say it that way because my story and my message tonight includes multiple sobriety dates. And I'll get to that. But I'll start by setting the stage, saying that I am going to share my experience, which specifically my experience with the disease of alcoholism, my strength, which is the solution that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my hope, which is what it's like now. And my hope is for each of you to connect with some of the things that I share, for that to either strengthen your recovery or to help you find recovery, because it's been the greatest gift that I've received in my life. I'm a child of the 70s. I was born in the early 70s in North Carolina. I didn't know it at the time and really until much later, but my parents were having a summer fling. My father and mother, a biological father and mother, were college students, one in Virginia and one in North Carolina. And I'm very grateful that my biological mother chose to have me and put me up for adoption. And I was adopted at birth, and the people that I know as mom and dad are two of the kindest, most loving, best parents that anybody could ask for. My biological father was a college professor at the time. My mother was a teacher. Shortly after I was born, we moved to Memphis, Tennessee, which is where they're from and where I spent my elementary school years. We lived in North Alabama for a period after that, and then we came to Georgia right before high school. But as I think back about my childhood, it was really sort of an idyllic childhood. When I say that they were loving and kind and giving, not alcoholics. In fact, my father could, mother didn't really drink, and my father could, buy a six-pack of beer that might last in the fridge for, 6 months. My memories are positive. I excelled in school. Excelled at athletics. I had friends. From the outside looking in, it looked like a fantastic existence. I didn't really know it at the time, but looking back, I was, with all of that, not comfortable in my own skin. My earliest memories are filled with anxiety, worrying about, what you thought of me, what everybody thought of me, was I good enough? There was some hole in my life that I didn't know how to fill. I tried to fill it by being what you wanted me to be, by excelling at whatever situation I was put into. When I was 13, summer between 7th and 8th grade, my two best friends and I decided that we needed to, we'd heard from our friends at school that, some of them had drank, taken liquor from their parents, and it sounded fun or something like, we wanted to try. We figured out a way to get a bottle of vodka. They spent the night at my house. We just proceeded to get drunk. What I remember of that is probably similar to a lot of kids' first-time experience with alcohol. My two friends drank, one of them to the point of blacking out and making a complete fool of himself, both of them getting sick, and me having the best time that I'd maybe ever had. Woke up the next morning, they were hungover, and I couldn't wait to do it again. So I did. That was my first experience, but I fell in love with it. It progressed, and by the time I was in high school, I was, drinking or getting as deep into recreational chemistry as I could every chance I could. which meant it was just about pretty much every weekend. And that's what I did. You know, somehow I was able to continue to perform at school and athletics, and it was just what I did, and really no consequences other than, you know, occasionally making a fool of myself. But as it progressed, and I had no idea I had the disease of alcoholism, you know, I was just doing what the people around me did. I went to college, and I thought that everybody's life revolved around partying, because mine did. If I wasn't drinking or, again, experimenting with other things, then I was planning or thinking about or plotting or figuring out how, you know, the next time was going to go. As I progressed, I started to, you know, have some more consequences. You know, somehow, you know, it really started to get bad probably my third year in college, and I went from being a good student to, you know, I have a recurring nightmare today, even at 53 years old, and I've had it multiple times, and it will be, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks into the semester, and drop ad may or may not have ended. That's the period where you can drop your class, and there will be one or two classes that I'm enrolled in that I haven't been to yet. And I have no idea what to do. And that's because that was my experience. I'd always been focused on school. It was important to me. I knew it was important. Yet partying was more important. Consequences started to pile up. And I was on the 6-year plan eventually in college. And around my 4th year, it got to the point where I needed to be able to hit the eject button, or, you know, I was going to burn things down. And so I figured out that I could medically withdraw from school and clean up all of the zeros and Fs that I had on my transcript for that semester. And so I came home and told my parents I had a problem, and I ended up going to treatment. And I went to treatment here at a place called Ridgeview, and was there for a good long while, and got exposed to this program. And that's where I first saw the steps. And step one, we admitted that we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, I could understand that my life was unmanageable because I was a complete mess. And, you know, in every other area of my life, I, you know, figured out how to manage. But when it came to alcohol, and in particular some other things, you know, I could not choose going to class or doing this or managing my money or whatever, because getting what I needed was more important. I could understand that, and that allowed me to hang out for a little while, and I was escaping consequences. I was in some ways, you know, happy to be there, but the whole powerless thing did not make sense to me at all. You know, I was not powerless over, you know, a drink or something else. That made no sense to me. And so when I got out, after I'd gotten sort of all the people that needed something from me, you know, off my back, and I, you know, re-enrolled in school, pretty quickly I said, you know what, I can drink. And I did. Somehow I was able to go back to class regularly, and I did need a geographical cure. I'd been going to school at the University of Alabama, and if you've ever spent any time in T-Town, there's a lot of partying that goes on. And so all the people, the treatment center, my doctor, my parents, you know, all said, you can't go back there. I was like, all right, I'll go to Athens, Georgia, and I'll finish up there, you know. What was interesting is I found the same types of people there that were in T-Town and continued doing what I was doing. And you know, one night, a girlfriend had just ended a relationship, and, you know, I was, couldn't understand that, and was frustrated, knew that I wanted to go, you know, change the way I feel and go out. And I said, yeah, it's probably not a good idea. And so I went and I worked out. I went to the gym, and I got out, and it was about midnight, and I still had that itch. And I said, well, I'll just go down and, you know, have a drink. About 8 or 9 drinks later, I needed to get home. And this was before Uber. And so I drove home. I guess I wasn't driving very well because the blue lights came, and they decided to help me and I, you know, ended up in jail for a DUI. I told myself, you know, years later that that was meant to be, because when I went to Hokie Jackson DUI school in Athens, Georgia, I met somebody there, and we started dating. And, you know, not long after that, I came home and told my parents, you know, I've met the person that I'm going to marry. And they're like, oh, where'd you meet her? And I'm like, DUI school. You know, isn't that where everybody, you know, meets the love of their life? We ended up getting married. You know, my dad, still remember what he said. He's like, you know, well, at least y'all have something in common. We got married. You know, somehow she had been to treatment. I had been to treatment but wasn't staying sober. You know, we'd been exposed enough to the program and had enough of life, you know, beating us up that somehow I was able to start a career and, you know, start building a life without burning things down yet. But I absolutely was an alcoholic. And if you looked at how I lived, I still built my life around drinking and changing the way I felt. And, you know, for the next, I guess, about 8 years or so, this disease does what it does, and things got, you know, progressively worse. Same time, you know, I was functioning in the world. I guess I truly was a functioning alcoholic, had a couple of kids, I started a career, bought a house, and from the outside, again, everything looked like it was going well. But, you know, by the time I was, you know, my late 20s, early 30s, really right up until around 2001, 2002, it got to the point where I had a daily habit. I was drinking and doing other things to allow me to drink, you know, pretty much 24/7. And that's what I did. If I was awake, then I was consuming something to change the way I felt. It got to the point where, you know, I wasn't taking care of things financially. I was putting my kids, who were toddler and an infant, you know, I was taking them into situations, putting their life at risk, driving around intoxicated. I was doing things that I wouldn't normally do if I wasn't impaired. I was essentially stealing, and all of this to keep my habit going. And I don't want to spend a ton of time on what it was like, but I want to give you the picture that my disease had completely taken over my life. And it got to the point where I didn't care about anybody. I didn't care about the people that were closest to me. I surely didn't care about the people that I interacted with. And it got to the point where my bottom, while it became financial, and it became, in the end, my wife had had enough. You know, essentially, she was going to leave me with the kids. And so I was, you know, facing all of that, but that wasn't enough. She'd been threatening that for months and years. What it really came down to was I didn't want to live anymore. Because the thing that I had turned to fill that hole that I described, that I remember having from, you know, the earliest point in my life, turned on me, stopped working. I could have plenty to drink and plenty to do, and yet I still, you know, didn't want to be here. And so finally, hitting that bottom where I just didn't want to continue, I'd been to treatment before. I had thought that might be a good idea, and so I decided to get help. And even then, it wasn't like I really wanted to do it. Some of the people here, you know, may remember me back then. We started going to a meeting. My wife had me, you know, go to a 12-step meeting. I picked up a white chip. I was intoxicated at the time. I didn't mean it. I was, again, just trying to get people off of my back. Over a period of, you know, probably 3-4 months, I probably picked up 15 or 20 white chips. I finally hit bottom where I was at least willing to be removed from the situation that I was in. And that's what I needed. I needed to be completely removed because I could not stop. And so I went into treatment. Fortunately, also, I got a sponsor. And I think that's one of the most, that is one of the vital things that I did, and in my experience, one of the vital things we need to do in order to get sober. And I got a competent sponsor, a sponsor who had worked the steps, who was working with others, who asked, you know, a person that asked me to tell my story tonight. He immediately got me into the steps. Back to the first step, admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life become unmanageable. It was a lot easier this time to admit that I was powerless because I had a lot more evidence that I don't have power over alcohol. Yeah, there were times that I could drink and get away with it. There were times where I could, you know, maybe have one here or there, or maybe have 10 and have no consequences. But there were other, I couldn't predict when that was going to be. And I recognized that I truly was powerless because, as the book says, once I put the first one in, I could not predict whether that was going to go on and for how long. And that was my experience. The night that I got the DUI, I went out with the intention of having one drink. 8 more drinks later, I'm in jail. That was not my intention. And the unmanageability was apparent. My wife, my kids, my situation at work, my finances, my relationships, the betrayals that I did to the people closest to me. Many of them, you know, didn't know it at the time, but, you know, I would have to go and talk to them later. So step one was not difficult for me. Steps two and three were very difficult. And part of the reason I think I was unwilling to get sober when I first got exposed to the program, when I went to treatment, you know, 8 or 9 years earlier, is I did not have a higher power. Well, I had a higher power, but I believed it was me. I believed at some point in my childhood, I believed that, you know, if I wanted something, then it was dependent upon me. I was agnostic, if not atheist. And so reading higher power and God in steps two and three, I just completely shut down. That was, you know, my experience. And I'd been raised, you know, going to a church. You know, that was very difficult for me. But what I found and what I realized was that after accepting that I'm an alcoholic in step one and I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable, if you stop there, that's a pretty hopeless place to be. You know, the principle of step two is hope. In order to get into that hope, my sponsor told me, hey, look, you don't have to figure out who your higher power is. You just need to admit it's not you. Use the group. It's relatively straightforward to believe that a group of people, you know, with a common cause, is a higher power than one person trying to do it alone. So that's where I started. And then in step three, he had me, you know, get down on my knees and say the third step prayer. And at the time, I thought, you know, this is awkward. And I didn't believe in prayer, but I did it. And over time, I started to, it started to make sense. Then I got to the real work initially, which was doing step four and step five. And my experience with step four the first time around, I wouldn't recommend it. I took way too long. I used the sheets and the Joe and Charlie style that I think a lot of people do, and I found it to be very beneficial. And once I got it down on paper and I actually did a step five, it wasn't a white light experience, but it was amazingly freeing because I told my sponsor things that I'd never told anybody before. My experience was I didn't feel ashamed. It was very freeing. And at some point, I don't remember exactly when it was, but at some point between my fifth step getting into my eighth and ninth step, I started to feel a sense of peace and serenity that I didn't know possible. And what I realized was that was what I was looking for all along. And it's the greatest gift of recovery for me is I finally felt comfortable in my own skin. Step six and seven, in four and five, I had learned about my defects of character. I had a lot of resentments. I mean, I think I had well over 100 resentments. I'm a bit of a perfectionist and OCD, and you know, I listed, you know, everybody you know, pretty much in my life, because if I met you, I probably had a resentment against you. I realized that most of, you know, the resentments were all similar. I think, you know, with all of them, what I found is, you know, yes, there were, you know, some people that, you know, had harmed me and acted out, but the resentment was really all about me. It wasn't so much about what they did. It was, you know, me placing some sort of expectation on how you were supposed to act around me, and you fell short, and therefore I had a resentment again. It was an incredibly freeing experience. And 6 and 7, where, you know, I learn my character defects and I ask God to make me willing, and then to let them go, and, you know, then ask Him to remove them. My experience is, you know, that's not a step that I can just take and it's done. Because my character defects are insidious. And a lot of times I'm not even aware when they show up. Steps 8 and 9, where I identified the people that I had harmed, and then, you know, became willing to make amends and made amends. What an awesome process that was. I was terrified at first, but in all of the amends that I've made, and I know not everyone has this experience, but what my experience is, everything that I was afraid of, I didn't need to be afraid of, and all of the amends went better than I expected. And the thing that I also learned is it's not about me saying I'm sorry. What it's about is it's about me being accountable, you know, for the things that I've done. And then by making amends, I become free of those things. All that weight that I've been carrying around for all the things that I've done to other people, whether they forgave me or not, I got relief. And so really, it wasn't about the other people. It is, but the person that benefits the most, in my experience, was me, from being able to let those things go. In step 10, I learned that, you know, this recovery, this gift that I've been given, contingent upon me continuing this program. And I say my continuous sobriety date is April 22nd of 2018. I guess I'm coming up on 7 years. And it's because what I believe is I have a daily reprieve. And that's been my experience. And it's contingent upon me continuing to do this program. And to me, that's what, you know, step 10 is all about. Step 11, I'll go back to remember that I was agnostic. My experience is once I became willing to believe in a power greater than myself, and my spirituality is the thing that I value most. You know, I have a higher power today that I choose to call God, and it's the most important relationship in my life. And it is the relationship that gives me peace, joy, you know, sort of, and everything good in my life. And in steps 11, I learned to pray and I learned to meditate. I have severe ADD. If you know me, it becomes apparent. So sitting still and meditating and listening to my higher power is not something that comes naturally. But I've found it to be a tremendous, tremendous, you know, benefit in my life. And then, you know, the magic really happens in step 12. That's all about being of service. And there's lots of ways to do service in this program. Initially, it started out and I was, you know, my sponsor and people in meetings had me doing service. And I didn't even realize what I was doing. You know, telling my story is being of service. Just being here. Every one of you, by being here, are being of service in this program. And but the gift for me really was when I started sponsoring other alcoholics and taking them through the steps, seeing the magic happen in their lives. It helps me, I think, as much or more than it does the people that I'm sponsoring, because it allows me to go back through the steps. It allows me to see that it doesn't get any better out there. Sometimes it makes me grateful that I'm not in active alcoholism. It is, and the book says that it's not to be missed, and I absolutely believe that. I talked about you know, my story having multiple sobriety days. And I think my experience is I really have three sobriety days. The first one was September 13th of 2002. And that's when I came into that treatment that I described. I got a sponsor, I worked the steps, and I got all the things that I've just, and for the first time in my life at age 31, I found peace and joy. And I was on fire for this program, sponsoring a bunch of guys, and my life got better than it ever had been before, professionally, with my family, with sort of everything. I did something that I don't recommend. But I started taking my program for granted. Got into a career that was fairly demanding. Started missing meetings. I started prioritizing work and life ahead of this program. And it's absolutely true for me that anything I put in front of this program, I'm bound to lose. Almost 3 years into the program, I found myself on a business trip and someone put a drink in my hand. And before I knew it, I had taken a sip. I was like, what am I doing? And then once I did that, I felt immediate guilt and shame. I didn't like the way that felt, so I had another. That evening, over 1,000 miles from home, I came to in a blackout in a strange place. I didn't know where. I was in a really dangerous situation by myself, well, with other people, but nobody that I knew, putting my life, everything that I had at risk. And that's how quick I went from everything going for me, within 3-4 hours of having a drink, I was risking it all. And it was a physically dangerous situation. Somehow I made it back to the hotel, and I wish that I'd called my sponsor that next morning, but I didn't. And so the next 9 months of my life were just absolutely miserable because I was living a lie. I was continuing, I had sponsees, I had a family, I had a position in my home group, and so it was a period where, I lived a double life for 9 months until, the disease eventually took me to a place where, I couldn't keep the secret anymore, and I didn't come home one night, and my wife knew what was going on, and fortunately then I did call my sponsor. And what I found was that all of you welcomed me back in with open arms. And boy, was I ashamed. I had to tell 4 sponsees what had happened. I had to tell my home group. I had to tell my wife, although she figured it out. Fortunately, y'all welcomed me back in, and I did the steps again. I had the same experience, but maybe even better and deeper than I had before. It wasn't easy. I do not recommend going out and coming back in. But the program worked. And so I got sober. Life got better and better and better and better. 11 years later, I guess it was around 2000, fast forward to April of 2018, I'm 11 years sober this time. It's more difficult for me to explain what happened this time. Yes, I was not as focused on the program as I needed to be, obviously, but I was still going to meetings. All I can say is that I was in a situation where I was tired. My wife had prescription medication that I knew would, it was a stimulant and knew it would give me extra energy. I had been prescribed that medication for ADD before. I knew I couldn't handle it, but I took it to change the way I felt. Then I kept taking it that night. And then I found myself exactly where I had been the last time that I put something in to change the way I felt. And it scared the hell out of me because I remember what happened and how miserable I was. And fortunately, this time I did call my sponsor in the morning. I worked the steps again, and it was an amazing experience. My lesson in all of that is everything I have today, and my life is amazing today. Everything that I have today is a result of me working this program. I am so grateful that I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful because if I had never been an active alcoholic, I believe I would still have that hole in my life that I felt when I was, a young child. And I would be filling it up with something. And this program has given me, again, a sense of peace and serenity that I didn't know was possible until I was in my 30s. I'm almost at time, and I do want to share one more thing, and then I'll wrap it up. My experience is if I put recovery first, and I rely on this program, my life just keeps getting better and better. And it's not that there aren't trials and difficult things to go through. A few years ago, my wife, who is also in the program, after 15 years of sobriety, decided that she was not an alcoholic. She chose to go back out. It reached a point a couple of years ago where it was pure hell. I'm grateful in a way because I got to experience what I put my parents and family members and friends through, but I don't wish it on anybody. The reason that I share that is, fortunately, somebody had been telling me for years, you need to go to Al-Anon. In a place of complete despair, where I was certain that our marriage was over, that our family was over, I didn't know what was going to happen, I went. My experience there is that this is a family disease. Some of us can benefit from Al-Anon. I certainly did. If you're focused on early recovery here, stay here. But once you're in recovery, if you think that's interesting, I highly recommend it because it has been phenomenal in terms of helping me with the family disease. Thank you for the opportunity. I wish y'all a great night. Thank you.
Thank you, JC, and I'm not going to call you JC number two. I'm sorry. I can't do it.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Take me where the promise.